From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there's a lot going on in Washington. House Republicans are getting ready to vote on their tax cut plan. The vote could come tomorrow. In the Senate, leaders have added a measure to their tax bill that would repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate.
Roy Moore is still in the race in Alabama to fill Attorney General Jeff Sessions' old Senate seat, despite calls for Moore to drop out and Sessions to drop in as a write-in candidate. And this is all, of course, a day after Sessions was grilled by members of Congress on what he knew when about Russian interference in the U.S. election.
Here and Now political analysts join us now. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Angela Rye, Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we will get to Roy Moore in a minute, but I do want to start with tax cuts because this is something that could affect every single American. Paris, does it make it more or less likely that a plan will pass with a repeal of the individual mandate in it?
I think it makes it more likely that a plan will pass, I think, because the Republicans in the Senate want to be able to deliver on not only tax cuts, but overcoming what they failed to do a few weeks back when they did not deliver on repeal and replacing of Obamacare. So this is a smart thing that they are doing politically.
But and you when think you that see, John McCain and Jeff Flake and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Bob Corker, they're all going to vote for a tax cut package after all that's happened?
Well, I mean, listen, I think at the end of the day, these are Republicans who know that if the president has committed himself to saying publicly and privately that he will not sign anything that is going to be burdensome, that does not directly cut taxes for the middle class and reduce the corporate rate for 20%. This is a bipartisan issue. These are things that those Republicans that you just named can go home and tell the constituents, I did this for you, and this will directly benefit you, and this is the positive thing. And when you add on the fact that this repeal of the mandate is on there, you already have people like Senator John McCain saying yesterday after the lunch where it was announced that he was open to supporting it. So there's momentum for this tax cut to happen in addition to tying it to the portion of the repeal and replace of Obamacare.
Angela, just jump in.
Yeah, so I actually couldn't disagree with Paris Moore. I think the reality of this is it's going to be very difficult for senators who live in states where it's been an uphill climb for them, frankly, to get into office. Think about Lisa Murkowski, who had to win a write-in election. It's hard to sell them on the fact that this is something that works for them when everyone knows that's not the case. The tax reform bill by itself is one that only benefits millionaires and billionaires. To add on an Obamacare repeal, an Obamacare mandate repeal, not only undoes everything about the Affordable Care Act, it also subjects 13 million Americans to not having health care coverage. And it also will ensure that Medicaid endures some additional cuts. That is not something that these senators can go back home and sell.
But Angela, just to take a cynical look at this, I mean, you're right. The Congressional Budget Office said killing the mandate would lead to 13 million people losing their insurance.
Right.
The Republicans do need this because getting rid of the mandate and essentially getting rid of Obamacare lessens the deficit that their cuts will create. So they need it on that level, too. But we saw what happened in the Virginia elections. People came out of those polls and said they wanted to keep Obamacare. Some could say, shouldn't Democrats let Republicans just waltz down this path?
I think that this is when politics gets in the way of policymaking. So, yes, that would mean a win for Democrats, Robin, but it means that Americans all over the country, regardless of their party affiliation, suffer. And I think that's where we have to lay politics aside and do what's in the best interest of the country. Republicans in the Senate and the House continue to demonstrate that they could care less about their constituents and their needs, and they would rather help them feel like they're living out the American dream by putting forth policy prescriptions that are really poisonous for them, quite literally could be result in their death. I think that's irresponsible, and that's not why they were elected.
Okay,
well,
a poisonous policy
prescription was the Obamacare bill to begin with.
That's not true,
and
Paris,
we've seen
millions of people who now have coverage. 20 million people have health care coverage now because of Obamacare.
We can have the conversation
about talking point.
No, it's not a talking point. We can have the conversation about whether or not the Affordable Health Care Act was actually affordable. We know that they couldn't keep your doctor. We know the premiums went up. And we know that a lot of people are faced with now the financial burden of this bill. And so there's a lot of problems with it. So there are things
there are
that
also
can stay.
A lot of benefits of it. I know I kept my doctor and my premium went down.
Well, Angela, you are one of the few, because that is not the case for a lot of Americans out there.
So you would rather subject 13 million more people to rising premiums? Paris, just with the Obamacare mandate repeal alone, everyone who has health care coverage right now under an Obamacare plan, they would see premiums increase over the course of the next 365
days. They're already seeing
days.
The premiums increase, Angela, from Arizona, over 100 and some odd percent increase. There's
no
difference.
Paris, and I know
Obamacare
that that's
created,
the
it's not,
like
a, it's not an anecdote, it's a fact.
It is an anecdote.
Angela,
it's
accept
not bad.
The fact.
Okay.
I'm from Arizona.
One
premiums went up in Arizona because of Obamacare.
That is
fact.
You guys, the truth is, even you know, on both sides of the aisle, the thinking was that Obamacare needed to be fixed, just whether or not it should be thrown out. Yeah.
The truth is also, it would be malpractice if, with just 5 minutes left in our segment, we didn't even talk about Roy Moore. So I want to ask you about that.
Sorry.
Paris, do you think it's time for Roy Moore to get out of the race?
I think it's time for Roy Moore to have an honest conversation with the voters in Alabama who have supported him for decades. If Roy Moore feels that – it's 2 points. If Roy Moore feels that the allegations are false and are wrong, he should fight it like anybody would. But if there's any shred of truth to it, Roy Moore should do the best.
Well, what do you think?
I think it's up to the people of Alabama to decide that. I think it's up to them, because this is what we always do wrong. We always forget that it is not up to Washington pundits or the people that are in the political class in D.C. It is up to those people in Alabama. And the polling has showed that he's not cratering.
Yeah, but even Sean Hannity, let's just listen for a second. Even
and like I said, Sean Hannity is correct. Sean Hannity said if there's any shred of truth to it, you have 24 hours to come clean and figure it
out.
Let's
listen. Let's listen.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the judge has 24 hours. You must immediately and fully come up with a satisfactory explanation for your inconsistencies. You must remove any doubt. If he can't do this, then Judge Moore needs to get out of this race.
So, Paris, that's a little more than you said. He's saying he's got to say something. You're saying it's up to the voters, but that would
it
be...
Is, it's not Sean Hannity's call. It's not Mitch McConnell's call. It is up to the voters. Look, President Trump went out and said, I want Luther Strange. That's the irony about this whole thing. He said, I want Luther Strange. His competitors and the voters in Alabama said, Mr. President, we like you. We support you. We want to make America great again, but we feel that Roy Moore is our guy. It is not up to Washington... pundits and commentators and politicians to decide what Alabama voters want. Look, we know that Bill Clinton, go back, there were allegations against him when he ran for attorney general and governor, but the people of Arkansas...
Roy Moore.
No, but the people, but I'm saying the people in Arkansas said, we still believe in you and we disregard what
was
saying.
Clinton
so it's
was
up
impeached.
To the voters.
Clinton was impeached, and I think many Republicans are
for
worried.
Lying and obstruction of justice.
Right, and many Republicans are worried that Moore, if elected, will be facing an ethics investigation. That's what Mitch McConnell says.
Angela, what do you think of all this?
So one thing that I think is important is for Republicans who are voting in the election in Alabama is for them to vote their conscience. And by that, I mean, if there are 35% of Alabamans who are evangelicals, we know that Roy Moore spent his evening yesterday at a church revival. I want for those evangelicals to lead the way, to rely on their faith, and demonstrate the fact that there is no place for sexual assault, sexual harassment, or attempted rape in the United States Senate. I want them to lay some of their traditional values inside in favor of what is the correct and right thing to do. You can forgive the sinner. You can hate the sin, but that doesn't mean he deserves to be your United States Senator because you've been looking away for decades.
Look,
that's irresponsible on all of our parts.
We only have a couple minutes now. And Paris, I have to ask you about one of my favorite things that I've heard on talk television recently, which was you last night talking about Jeff Sessions and his grilling yesterday. And he said he forgot the meeting in which George Papadopoulos talked about the Russians and the Russians wanting a meeting until he heard the news reports. And now he remembers, and he does remember that he shut him down and said, we are not going to meet with the Russians. But you suggested that this was a matter of memory and that Jeff Sessions just needed some ginkgo biloba, which is the first time, this was on CNN, and it was just a lovely moment because you rarely hear ginkgo biloba. But really, do you think this is a matter of memory and not speaking the truth?
Yeah, I do think it's a matter of memory, and I think that we try to read into it and make it seem like it's sinister. I don't think that it is. I think the senator, now attorney general, 70 years old, there was a grueling campaign and probably didn't remember all of the little things that he probably thought were insignificant or not that important, and he just forgets. And if he has a problem with remembering certain things, let's just do things to help his memory out a little bit. But I don't think that there's a sinister nature. I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's trying to deceive. This is a very honorable man who's been in these positions for a long time and has a stellar record of being truthful. And I think that to suggest that he's misleading the Congress, misleading the American people, is just wrong.
Angela, in the 30 seconds we have left, I want to ask you one quick question. We got some news today that Richard Cordray has announced he's resigning at the end of the month from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Do you think this is the end of the CFPB?
I think it's the end of the CFPB as we know it. Under Cordray's tenure, they have responded to over 1.3 million consumer complaints and have returned more than $12 billion to customers via their enforcement actions. Yeah. I do not think we will see that type of CFPB under this administration.
Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Today, Russian lawmakers move closer to requiring that any international media outlet in the country be listed as a foreign agent. This is seen as retaliation against the decision by the U.S. Department of Justice last week requiring the Kremlin-backed news outlet RT to register as a foreign agent here in this country. The DOJ says RT was a tool the Russians used to meddle in the 2016 U.S. election. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us from Moscow. And Sarah, who exactly is this going to affect if it does go through? Because a lot of media outlets have reporters based in Russia.
Well, I think the point is that it's been left deliberately vague. We've been asking that same question ever since this topic came up, and nobody can really give a straight answer. But looking at the law itself, essentially, this is a tool that can be used against any foreign media operating in Russia, any foreign media that gets money from abroad. And that doesn't just mean money from foreign governments. It also means from private individuals and from any other foreign source. So it's an extremely broad brush, if you like, that's now practically exists in Russian law. It has to pass through the upper house. It has to be signed by President Putin, but that's pretty much taken as read. So it's a bit of a sword of Damocles that's hanging now over the head of all foreign media operating in Russia, because it can theoretically be deployed against any foreign media if and when the justice ministry here in Russia deems that that's necessary.
Well, it could be deployed against you, the BBC's Sarah Rainsford there in Moscow. And by the way, remind us why the Justice Department here in the U.S. made their decision about RT. You know, tell us more about what RT is.
Well, RT is a Kremlin-backed channel. It's a channel that broadcasts in many languages around the world. And in the United States, a U.S. intelligence report suggested that RT was one part of the Russian government's, the Kremlin's, attempts to interfere in the U.S. elections. So it was picked out, singled out by intelligence reports saying that it was deliberately biased in favor of Donald Trump and was part of what those reports called President Putin's influence campaign in the U.S. elections. So it was singled out, and there was pressure then for the U.S. Attorney General to oblige RT to register in the United States as a foreign agent. And what we have now is a direct response to what's happened in the United States. But actually in Russia, the law that's being approved goes further and it goes deeper.
Well, but what does it mean that RT has to register as an agent?
Well, it means that in theory, it means that any information that they put out, so in theory, their website, in theory, their TV channel, needs to be labeled as coming courtesy of the Russian authorities. So essentially, both in the US and in Russia, media operating who are blacklisted in this way would have to declare that they were broadcasting on behalf of a foreign state. And of course, there's a whole lot of stigma attached to that. Of course, it harks back to the Cold War. It harks back to talk of propaganda instead of news. And it suggests that these companies labeled in either country are producing propaganda, are not objective reporters. So it's not a good move for anybody that ends up on these lists. And also in Russia, In particular, it means a whole lot of extra auditing, a lot of extra checks. And if any of the companies involved don't comply with any of the obligations, then they face being fined. And we have heard from MPs that they also potentially being face being kicked out of the country.
Well, there's also an RT America. Larry King has a show on it. But you're there in Moscow. How are journalists there reacting to this? I mean, of course, the Justice Department here and all the agencies here have determined that Russia interfered in the 2016 elections or tried to interfere. But have you met journalists, Russian journalists there, who think that it's an unfair characterization of RT to say it's an agent?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, Russian media as a whole, there's an awful lot of state-backed media here, state-funded media, and the general consensus is that RT is simply providing an alternative point of view and that America didn't like that. And that's why the U.S. Justice Department has forced them to register. That's the sort of official establishment view here in Russia. Of course, there are others who don't agree, who believe that RT is part of a propaganda campaign by Russia. But there are other people as well who see a much more nuanced picture, which suggests that going after RT was bound to have ramifications because it allows Russia to cry foul and to say that freedom of the press is under attack in the United States. The defenders of democracy have proven themselves to be hypocrites. I mean, it's given great fuel for Russian state media to laugh at and to criticize the United States every day from the TV screens that I'm watching.
Well, speaking of which, while we have you, Sarah, you know, over the weekend, President Trump appeared at first to accept President Putin's claim that Russia did not interfere in the U.S. elections, you know, against the thinking of Trump's own intelligence agencies. He walked that back a bit. But how was that received in Russia?
Well, it's peculiar, the relationship between Russia and Donald Trump, because, of course, when he was first elected, Russia thought there was going to be a real uptick in relations, that things were going to get better, everyone was going to be friends and all was going to be brilliant. But that hasn't happened. And so what we've seen is this kind of consensus that Donald Trump really would like to be friends with Vladimir Putin and to improve relations with Russia, but that he's being blocked from doing that by the U.S. establishment. So that's the latest developments have been seen precisely in that context, that Donald Trump was telling the truth. He doesn't believe that Russia meddled in the U.S. elections, but he's being forced to say that he does by the establishment. So it's a kind of odd relationship. But, you know, it comes in a really quite toxic atmosphere now. Watching the media, even talking to some people on the streets, you know, you really feel that things are going backwards here. The mood is really souring. Mm.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, back on the home front, organic food is a $40 billion industry and growing. And that has the attention of farmers discouraged by years of low prices for the conventional crops. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story of a Nebraska farm making the switch to the more lucrative organic market.
A couple years ago, Berkey Farms started talking about the future, not only how they farm, but also how they're going to make money. The issue was conventional corn and soybeans, which were and still are selling at prices where farmers are just hoping to break even, and it didn't look like that would change.
So we're looking at years of maybe making money, maybe not.
Eric Thalkin had just moved back to southeast Nebraska with his wife to be closer to her extended family, the Berkeys. They looked at moving into a riverside cabin on a piece of family land. Thalkin didn't like the cabin, but the hayfield next to it caught his eye. We got in his truck to go see it.
The field was alfalfa, and it was honestly pretty weedy. And so it gave me the idea that this could be certified organic right away. And it looked like fun and money.
Falcon started working for Berkey Farms and convinced them to switch that weedy alfalfa field to organic. Today, it's covered with rows of corn stalks rattling in the breeze.
So this is certified organic.
Falcon pulls back the husks on a few ears like he's unwrapping a Christmas present.
That's a good ear corn there. Free of any ear rots, bugs, anything like that.
After trying out one field, Berkey Farms is now switching the whole farm to organic. And it's a lot of land, 2,400 acres. It takes 3 years to be certified as an organic farm, 3 years with no genetically modified seed, no synthetic pesticides or fertilizer. But there is a significant payoff. That corn?
Some of it is sold at $8.80, some of it sold at $9.
And if it were a conventional crop this year?
Depending on how you market it, $3 to maybe $3.50.
So more than double.
Close to triple.
Those type of numbers perks the interest of farmers. Money talks.
Greg Lichtai oversees purchasing of organic grain for Schooler, a grain marketing company based in Omaha, Nebraska.
We see more farmers considering becoming certified organic.
There were 5 million acres of organic fields and pastures in the U.S. in 2016, according to the Department of Agriculture. That's still a small percentage of farmland overall, but places like Colorado, Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas have all seen a jump in organic acres. Lichtai says demand is growing in the organic sector, in large part from organic dairy and poultry farms that need organic corn and soybeans for animal feed. Production of those crops went up 30% in the U.S. just last year. But it's not enough. Half the organic corn and three-quarters of the organic soybeans used across the country are actually imported from places like Turkey, India, and Argentina.
So, yeah, there's a shortage in that this country is importing to meet the demand.
Sounds like an opportunity, but switching to organic is not so easy as ditching GMO seed and putting away the herbicide. Farmers have to buy new machinery, like cultivators and rotary hoes, to stir up weeds out of the soil. And you can't just grow corn and soybeans, so you have to learn to grow things like oats or clover. Craig Chase of Iowa State University takes questions from farmers considering going organic. But many of them view it as too big a change, Chase says, especially since the average farmer is in their late 50s.
And they're going to say, I may only have 5 to 10 years left growing crops at all. And the question is, do I want to go ahead and invest in a new system?
And Eric Thalkin says even though organic grain prices are higher, the margin for error is smaller. Let's say a farmer's late with the cultivator. Weeds can get out of control, and there are no herbicides to help out.
To pull off a good organic crop, you have to be good on every single step through the way. If someone didn't set a cultivator right, or if you got the wrong cover crop mix, you could literally cut your yields in half.
It's a risk, but with the farm economy in the doldrums, it's one that more farmers are willing to take. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
If you've been to a Starbucks recently, maybe you noticed people paying for their lattes with a smartphone. The company says these mobile payments now account for about 30% of its transactions. And according to a report from Forrester Research, the mobile payment industry is expected to grow around 20% a year over the next several years. But it hasn't replaced cash and credit cards yet. Why not? Joining us now is Emily Glazer of The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Emily.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. And for people who haven't used their phone to pay for things, just briefly tell us how it works.
So this is something that is not catching on too much yet. But basically, if you have a phone and maybe you have Apple Pay, maybe you have something called Chase Pay, maybe you have Starbucks, its own application. Basically, instead of whipping out your credit card, your debit card or cash, or even your wallet, you can use your phone and it'll scan some sort of different technology through your phone and that will count as the payment.
I use my phone to pay for exactly one thing, and that is groceries at the supermarket on Apple Pay. That's about it. Why hasn't this taken off to a greater degree?
Jeremy, you're in the minority there. So many consumers do not use any kind of mobile payments. And it's interesting because anyone from retailers to technology firms to banks to other financial firms like credit card companies think that this is the future or this is the now, right? They want to get in on this space because they can make money either from processing credit card fees because you load your credit cards digitally through the app. And every time it is digitally swiped, right, because we're not doing it physically anymore, or putting the chip in, then they'll get a fee. And then the merchants, so the grocery store that you're shopping at or a retailer or a restaurant, also has to pay a fee if there's a charge. So that's how these companies are making money. But customers are really saying, you know what? not sure if I'm ready for that yet.
Hmm. And I would think that Apple Pay would be one of the big players. It turns out PayPal is by far the biggest, then Visa Checkout, Amazon Pay, then Apple Pay, and then Android Pay.
Exactly. And you didn't even mention Chase Pay there, which is some of what we've been covering, which is how banks are trying to get in this space because they so desperately want to have their tens of millions of customers that use them for checking account, saving account, debit card, credit card. They want to keep those customers as they eventually migrate to their phones, even if it isn't happening just yet.
So why aren't they winning the race, the banks?
You know, banks, someone has described this to me before in an interesting way. Banks have the customer base, like I mentioned. You know, JPMorgan Chase has 94 million credit card and debit card users. So it has the scale. But one person described it to me as banks are very good at the plumbing, but they're not very good at designing the faucets. So banks are not always well known for the most beautiful app design, if you will. That's something that technology companies typically tend to be better at. You know, they move more quickly, and it's all about continuing to evolve as this is a very fast-changing space with fast-changing technology. If you think about it, 5 years ago, could we have even imagined paying with our phones? And 10 years ago, you know, thinking about what the iPhone or any kind of mobile phone can do right now would have seemed a little bit like science fiction. So banks have the mass and they have the scale and they have the money to invest in this, but so far they just haven't quite figured out a way for it to all click.
That's Emily Glazer at the Wall Street Journal talking about mobile payments. Let us know whether you use mobile payment applications to buy things at hereandnow.org. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Jurors in New Jersey are still deliberating today in the federal corruption trial of Democratic Senator Robert Menendez. He's accused of taking gifts like private flights and campaign donations from a Florida eye doctor, Solomon Melgen, in exchange for favorable treatment for Melgen in government dealings. As of Monday, the jury was deadlocked on the charge, bribery. Lawyers for Menendez are pushing for a mistrial, and this all could have big ramifications in Washington. Joe Hernandez covers New Jersey for WHYY. He's outside the courthouse. And Joe, the jury's deadlocked, but we also know an alternate juror was put in this week. What's going on?
Well, the latest we heard was on Monday when the jury came back with a note to the judge and said, we're deadlocked. What do we do now? And yesterday we didn't hear anything from them. But you're right to mention that this is actually day 7 of jury deliberations, but they had to restart on Monday because on Thursday the judge excused a juror who had planned a vacation. She had to leave to go on a cruise, and the judge and the attorneys agreed ahead of time back in August that they would let her go. And so since the jury hadn't reached a verdict by Thursday, the judge let her go, swapped in an alternate, told them to restart deliberations. And so now they're back in the jury room. The judge has told them he's not going to let them go just yet to keep trying to reach a unanimous verdict.
Well, now, this sounds weird to many people. We thought you couldn't go on jury duty and get off it by saying, you know, you had something else to do. So is this at all controversial? Might there be calls for a mistrial because they've allowed a juror to go?
A lot of people are definitely questioning it, and the defense attorneys have said when the jury came back on Monday and said we're deadlocked, the defense attorney said, well, maybe it's time that we call a mistrial and everybody goes home. The judge said, not yet, let's keep trying. But people are definitely questioning why it occurred, although back in August, the judge and the attorneys all agreed to let this woman go on vacation, partly because I think they didn't think the trial would really last this long. There was 9 weeks of testimony, and now we're in the second week of deliberation. So it's been kind of a lengthy process, longer than many people expected.
Okay. Well, remind us of the charges against Menendez.
Right. So he's facing a dozen counts, and his co-defendant, Florida eye doctor Solomon Melgen, is facing 11. And the reason there's a discrepancy there is because Menendez is facing an extra count of omitting some of these gifts on his annual Senate financial disclosure forms. But federal prosecutors are saying that the two men engaged in a bribery scheme for 7 years, that Menendez did favors for Melgen in exchange for free private jet flights and free hotel rooms and political contributions. And some of those favors include helping Melgen's girlfriends get travel visas and helping the eye doctor sort out an $8.9 million Medicare billing dispute at his ophthalmology practice.
Yeah, how's this being received in New Jersey? Just a bit ago, we were dealing with the Bridgegate scandal when people in the Governor Chris Christie administration, were charged and convicted of colluding to create really bad traffic on a bridge, you know, to punish a Democrat. So how's this, you know, a Democrat on trial, how's this being received there?
Right. I mean, it certainly does not help New Jersey's reputation historically for political corruption. I mean, in the past 2 years, we've had two high-profile federal corruption trials of public officials. There have been some calls already for Menendez to resign, to step down, mostly from Republicans. But people are watching closely to see what happens in the case and whether he, you know, whatever verdict the jury brings back, what he'll have to do after that.
Right. Well, and talk about that, because we've got the bigger picture of Washington and Republicans hoping to hold on to their majority so that they can get this tax cut vote through before a certain date. So how does this affect the balance in Washington?
Well, the Republicans do control the Senate right now, but it's kind of a thin margin. If you'll remember back to a couple months ago, I guess, when they were trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, one of the iterations of that repeal failed by only one vote in the Senate. So if Menendez were to resign or were forced out in the next month or month and a half, Republican Governor Chris Christie would appoint his replacement, and that would likely be a Republican and tip the balance a little bit more toward Republicans in the Senate. But New Jersey just elected a new governor who's a Democrat, so if Menendez stepped down or was forced out, you know, late January or after that, a Democrat would likely take his place, and then the balance of power would be the same.
Right. And if Menendez is found guilty, is that an automatic, that he's automatically out of office?
No. And the Senate would have to vote by two-thirds majority to expel him. So that vote would require, you know, a decent amount of Democrats going along with it.
So lots of drama here. Joe Hernandez from WHYY outside the courtroom in Newark, New Jersey, where we wait to hear what the jury in the Menendez trial is doing. Joe, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, now to Texas, where the president of Texas State University has suspended all fraternity and sorority activities on its campus following the death of a fraternity pledge. Matthew Ellis was found unresponsive Monday morning after attending a Phi Kappa Psi party the night before. His death is the latest in a string of similar incidents on campuses around the country, and it is again raising questions about how universities should regulate Greek activities. Dalia Jones has been covering this for KUT in Austin, which is not far from Texas State. Dalia, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And what do we know about the circumstances of Matthew Ellis's death?
As of now, all we do know is that he supposedly had gone to a party that the fraternity had hosted the night before. And the next morning when friends came to wake him up or to check on him, he was unresponsive. We know that when emergency officials got there, within the next few minutes, he was declared dead.
Hmm. And is anybody bringing criminal charges at this point?
As of now, we're seeing reports from local news agencies that San Marcos police chief says the event will likely result in criminal charges. But when I called to verify that from the city, an official said it was way too early to determine that. So we really don't have a clear answer as of now.
The university announced yesterday that it was suspending all Greek fraternities and sororities. Did they say how long that'll last?
No, we don't know. All we do know is that President Denise Trouth said a review will be done by the Student Affairs Office, which oversees Greek affairs, and they will then propose recommendations for reinstating the Greek organizations. But as of now, we don't know how long that'll take.
And what does the suspension entail at this point? Are they stopping all gatherings?
So, yeah, that means, you know, no new member events, no chapter meetings, no social functions or any of those type of activities until the review has been completed.
And of course, as we mentioned, this is not the only incident like this where a fraternity pledge has died. We've seen a similar situation in Tallahassee, Florida, at Florida State University. Obviously, there is the situation at Penn State University. Are people talking about just ending the Greek system on campus or just getting rid of all fraternities and sororities.
Yeah, yeah. On social media, I'm seeing a lot of agreement with what President Trout did, and just saying that Greek organizations are not really needed on college campuses now. So now you're seeing this type of feud between people who are not in part of these organizations and people who are part of these organizations, saying that they do need this for networking and brotherhood and sisterhood within these college campuses. So it's kind of a back and forth about this.
What are you hearing from people on the campus about this decision?
Yeah, so I went to Texas State, and I follow a lot of these students on Twitter and on Facebook, and a lot of these Greek organizations are kind of outraged that this one incident has caused the suspension of all of these Greek organizations, specifically from a lot of the National Panhellenic Council members, which are Greek organizations who seem a little bit outraged about this. But I am seeing others standing in solidarity and agreeing with what the president made the decision yesterday, the decision made by the president yesterday.
And the national chapter of Phi Kappa Psi said that this local chapter of the fraternity had been suspended last week, even before the party that Matthew Ellis attended. Have they explained any more about that?
No, they say that the issue is completely unrelated. They have not expanded on the issue at all. So we don't know if that's related at all to this.
That's Dalia Jones, a reporter with KUT in Austin, Texas. Dalia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Here and Now, and Thanksgiving is just a little more than a week away, if you can believe it. And if you've got questions, our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has answers and joins us now. Hi, Kathy.
Hey.
First question, how big a turkey should you get?
How many people are coming?
Yeah, and so how much?
At least a pound a person, because the name of the game is leftovers. You know, it's such a huge meal. People eat turkey, and they can eat a lot of turkey, but there's so many other dishes that go with it. If you figure a pound, pound and a half per person, you'll have plenty for leftovers.
Okay. And by the way, you've brought in a plate of food. I've almost finished mine.
Devoured.
During the break. So we've discussed this before, fresh versus frozen. And how long can you keep something frozen, and how do you thaw it?
Okay.
And not that I need to know, but I really need to know.
Yeah, right. I've always cooked a fresh turkey. I have a neighbor that raises turkey. I get a turkey from her or from my local butcher. But this year I went to the supermarket and I bought an all-natural frozen turkey. First of all, it takes a long, long, long time to thaw
That's
a turkey.
That's why I asked.
Yes. So you need to leave. Okay, ready?
Yesterday.
Not yesterday, but we're on it here. If you're going to get a frozen turkey, you need about 3 days to thaw it.
Wow.
It's a lot more time than you would actually think.
In the fridge?
In the fridge, ideally. Now, if you run out of time, what do? You fill a sink with cold, cold water, and you submerge the frozen turkey. It's still in the wrapper. You put a can of soup on it or something, so it's completely submerged in cold water. And it still takes a really long time. It's kind of shocking.
And cold, you don't want hot because you'd start cooking it.
No, no, no. Yeah. Everything's got to be cold. Right. You want to keep this safe. We have a link to the USDA website. You want to stay very safe. I've known people that have huge birds that fill a bathtub with very cold water, and you just keep flipping it and keeping cold water, because who has an empty sink big enough for a bird?
Well, and so with all of that, what's the advantage of the frozen? Why don't you just get a fresh one?
You know what? That is the million-dollar question. They're cheaper.
Okay.
So you can save some money. Sometimes people are given them from their offices, but take that thing out soon.
Well, now, sometimes people bought too many, and so they had to freeze
sometimes,
it. No one I know.
Is this a personal story,
yes,
Robin?
Yes, so I'm yes. desperate this year.
What about brining?
Brining. Okay, so that's the other thing. So I experimented with a frozen turkey, and I never brine my turkeys, but everybody seems to talk about brining. So I thought, okay, I'm going to...
What exactly is it?
Brining is when you submerge... Well, there's wet brining and dry. Wet is when you make a saltwater solution, and you fill it... 2 gallons worth of brine, you throw your turkey in. The idea is that it will make it moister, particularly for a supermarket turkey or if you're using a frozen supermarket turkey. However, you want to brine for 12 to 24 hours. So honestly, you need to start this turkey tomorrow. Yeah.
Did you brine this?
I did.
What's
I
in front of us right now, which people can see, by the way, at hearingnow.org.
So I made a very simple brine solution, salt, a little bit of sugar, some fresh thyme, fresh sage, peppercorns, and I let the turkey brine for about 10 hours. And you need refrigerator space. I think that the brining didn't do much.
Okay, because I was going to say, you've always told us just take a lot of salt and rub it into the skin.
That's the dry brine. You can do that. You want to be really cautious to make sure that you rinse off whatever type of brine you use. Otherwise, you will have an exceedingly salty turkey.
Okay.
What about the gravy?
The best part of the meal.
You've got a delicious gravy right here.
Thank you. Yeah. So here's what I do. You get the turkey. You've brined it. You've thawed it. You've spent 3 days doing this. This is another reason I don't want to brine. I don't want to spend another day. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people swear by it. I take the giblets, the neck, and the heart out of the inside of the turkey, and I put them in a pot with an onion, parsley, peppercorn, salt, and I start a stock, a very simple broth. Then when my turkey's done roasting, I put it on a carving board. I loosely cover it to stay warm, put the pan right on the burners. I take a little of the fat out, but not all of it. I put a little bit of flour in, I cook that, and then I strain that turkey stock right on top, cook it down. And that is it's the real deal.
I don't strain it. I just take all those globby.
Those bits and pieces. People like to add necks and gizzards. Not my thing. Go for it, Robin. Yeah,
it's just so dark and wonderful. Okay, Jerry.
On the side, you have here some cream spinach, and cranberry sauce.
I do. Quickly, the cream spinach. Every year, my dad loved cream spinach. He's been gone for a decade now, which is shocking. Yeah. I decided it was time. You know, Thanksgiving's really about traditional foods, but I always like to shake it up a little bit with one twist on it. So this year, right?
Isn't that spicy?
Jeremy's saying it's spicy. Wow. So I did it with, instead of traditionally it's cream and grated nutmeg, this is coconut milk, chili pepper, fresh ginger, and cardamom. So it has an Indian twist. It's spicy because a lot of the foods of Thanksgiving are quite... bland is not the right word, but mild. So this spinach really wakes up the plate, right?
Yeah,
the coconut milk. And it's a lot fewer.
And the cranberry sauce, just briefly?
My classic pineapples, cranberries, ginger, and toasted nuts.
Okay.
We need to have a cranberry sauce off with
Susan Stamberg.
Yes. Yeah, I know who
she uses horseradish.
Sorry, Susan.
Oh, thanks, Robin.
We'll have all these recipes.
No wonder I come back.
We'll have all these recipes at hearingnow.org. They are magnificent. And again, you know, start yesterday. We'll get going. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.